Okay, so where we left off when we ended last week was, and the slides weren't enough, we were talking about the different types of functions of law and everything else. And I had mentioned a couple, we had talked about the different types of, you know, with federal law and everything else. So for your purposes, and mark this in your notes, okay? This is going to be one that will be a question on this slide in the exam, okay? So I will give tips. Not all of them, but I will tell you from time to time. There will be a question or two on the exam talking about the hierarchy of law. It won't be put them in order, but there'll be a lot of my questions are like written fact scenarios, you know, like a description of something that happened, and so you can figure it out. But this is the hierarchy of the laws of the United States, of what happened. So at the top level, and we talked a little bit of this last week, is the Constitution. The Constitution covers everything in the country. And so that's what is the top. And so if you have a question about the law, and maybe eventually make it up to the Supreme Court, because they're going to want to be ultimately determining the Constitution. But remember also, each state has their own constitution. Illinois has a constitution, Ohio has a constitution, Michigan has a constitution, California has a constitution. So sometimes there are issues that are state only, a state law that doesn't affect the entire country, and it will be potentially decided by those courts, those states' respective Supreme Courts. Except for New York, because of New York, because they think themselves, because they're North and they're big and popular, their trial court is called the Supreme Court, and their Supreme Court is an appellate court, but other than that, the word Supreme Court is always on the top. And your Supreme Courts, whether it's the U.S. or the states, are going to be the ones interpreting all these types of laws below as to whether they are constitutional. Now, you can have a state court, a state law, that can also be appealed to the Supreme Court. So sometimes you'll have a state law, and it'll go through their court system, and they may not challenge it to the state's constitution. They may elect to challenge it straight to the Supreme Court. That's happened a ton in the news in the last 5 years with everything in the politics and so forth. But that's something that you can do. And that challenge there is even though it's a law that only applies to the state, it violates the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, is the highest of the highest. Okay? So that's your top of the chart. Second is statutes. Statutes are written down law. If somebody decided to write it down in a statute and say, this is the law of where you live. And statutes could be federal, so it covers everything. There are federal statutes. There are state laws. There are county laws and city laws. And all those are statutory and what statutes are written down. And that has, and what happens is the legislatures or governing bodies or in the city municipality, they pass those laws. Because they are there to remember laws or protect people and for predictability. And so they pass those laws and they write them down. And if someone thinks that that law is unconstitutional, they go to the next level and they challenge to the Constitution. A good example of a state law that's not a federal law, many states have legalized marijuana. But marijuana is not legal federally. There is not a legal statute that says every state in the union can sell marijuana, but many states have decided. And so that statute only goes to state level. And no one has challenged it to the Supreme Court because it's a commerce thing, and they probably wouldn't say it's unconstitutional. That's not something that says my constitutional rights are being violated because I live in some state that doesn't have a marijuana law. That probably wouldn't ever be a proper challenge. But that's a place where you have a statute that is state-based, but not yet federal. There are lots of things that people are trying to make federal laws that comes up in the news. I'm sure you hear about them and so forth. So sometimes what ends up happening is there's enough groundswell, enough change in the populace and everything else that it could eventually get there and they could maybe ultimately make a law. Now what's interesting is when we ultimately get down to common law, you can make court law, you can make it that it's the law of the land, and it doesn't have to be statutory, but it still can apply to everything. So I'll get there in a second, I'll give you an example of a common law that we have that was state-based, is now federally or nationally based, but there's no statute on it. So, top of the list, Constitution, second statute, third executive order. We've all heard executive orders all the time in the news in the last 5, 10 years or whatever because of what presidents are doing right and left. And so we hear what that is. But executive orders can also be federal and state. A governor can do an executive order. A mayor can do an executive order. And they have the power, because if you remember, our government is it's a tripartite government. It's judiciary, it's legislative, and it's executive. And there are certain powers that the executive branch is given, and they are allowed to issue certain orders. Now, those executive orders can be challenged as being unconstitutional in violation of the statute. So it is third on the list. And if one party or another, or somebody doesn't agree with the executive order, even an individual, and they don't agree with it, they can say, your executive order is in contrast to the statute, or it's unconstitutional. And it could be state, it could be federal. So that's the third down the list. After that comes an administrative order. Administrative order, one more other point. Statutes and executive orders are also, as I said, statutes are written down, executive orders are written down. So what sometimes happens is you write an executive order with an intent, but the language of how you wrote it makes it wrong. And so sometimes that executive order gets tossed by being unconstitutional, and then the executive, whether it's a mayor or a governor or a president, can maybe rewrite it, and it would be then potentially deemed constitutional. That has happened in the history of our country. Administrative order, yet another one that is written down as far as something you know to follow. Administrative orders are by bodies that are not part of our tripartite government. It's not the judiciary creating common law. It's not the legislature creating statutes. It's not the executive branch creating executive orders. Administrative order are bodies like, when you guys get out, and those of you who ultimately choose to sit for your exam to become a licensed architect, there is a governing body that manages and oversees the ethics of architects. And if you violate those ethics or you violate those rules, that administrative body has a series of rules that you have to follow, and they could subject you to fines and sanctions. In my profession as a lawyer, it's called the ARDC, and it's Attorney Disciplinary and Registration Committee. So I have to register every year as a lawyer, and then if I do something wrong that's against the ethical rules of being a lawyer, that administrative body has their series of rules, and some are national and some are state-based, and if I violate one of those rules, they could sanction me or even go so far. You hear about lawyers being disbarred and everything else. That's an administrative body, and they have administrative orders. So it's part legislative in the sense that they have this body that makes these decisions to create the laws. It's part executive because this body has somebody that is going to enforce and put those laws out. But it's not part of the normal government. It's this body that would be, or like I said, would affect different types of organizations out there, different types of professions. Again, as laws are for predictability and protection of society. And so that's why, like, if I go out and screw up as a lawyer, the reason why the ARDC would come against me and potentially either sanction me or take away my license is because what I was doing was potentially hurting clients or the public at large. So that's the administrative order. Common law. So I talked about a little bit a second ago. Common law is the next one down the list. Common law is the most prevalent law of the land, though. When you hear the term, it's the law of the land, most of the time it's going to be because it's common law. Common law are case-based. So when you have a dispute between the parties on a breach of contract, because we're going to talk about contracts a lot, or somebody slips and falls and there's a tort, an injury, those things go to court. And the judge will decide whether one party or the other should win or lose. And the judge will make their decision based on hundreds of years of similar type situations and other cases. And so what happens when I go in and argue a case in front of a judge, I file what's called a brief, a legal brief, which then takes, here's the facts of my case, and I'm going to briefly state to the court what the law of the land is. I'm going to say, in this case, Hadley v. Baxendale, back in 1842, there was a breach of contract, and here's what the court said the party should do. And I give the court various examples of what the law should be based on all of this history. And so what you do as a lawyer, a young lawyer, and you get in, is you go out and research your cases, you have these facts, you do research, and try to find cases that are very similar, and then you argue that to the court, and you briefly state, that's why it's called a brief, this is the law of the land. And then that case is decided on that. Now, sometimes there's novel cases, and that's new law, and then that maybe goes up to appellate court, and then it becomes written down, and that also becomes a law of land. Now, I mentioned there could be, and sometimes, and the law of the land normally is going to be state-based. So when I have disputes in Illinois, I ask my young associates, get me research on these cases and somebody that helps support our case here. They research and they come back and they're like, Mike, you know what? I can only find like two cases in Illinois. But I got one in Texas that's very similar. I got one in Ohio that's similar. I got one in New Jersey that's similar. And none of those cases have precedence, meaning the Illinois courts are not required to follow Texas, New York, and New Jersey. But because we can show that this is other states that think the same way, they want to protect and have predictability, and the facts are a scenario, the courts can take those into consideration. But they aren't required because state by state by state, they don't have to follow another state's rules. And I have had situations where I've argued in front of a court. They didn't have any Illinois cases, and they're like, counsel, I understand you got something from Michigan, but that's not jurisdiction. It doesn't require me to follow that. I can make my own decisions on what Illinois should do. So that's a state-by-state basis. But what can happen is common law is the U.S. Supreme Court can create common law by case law, and that will then apply to the law of the land. So there are two, and I don't give these because I try not to get into politics here, but there are two that are very, everybody knows about them because they're in the news. A number of states over the last 20 years started to adopt that you could have same-sex marriage. But not every state did. And so eventually that went to the Supreme Court, and they brought it on a constitutional basis. They said, I have equal rights and protections under the law of the U.S. Constitution. Constitutionally, all people created, I can do what I want, and I can marry if I want to. And they also brought in issues that the people that couldn't get married in certain states because they didn't allow to have same-sex marriage, there was discrimination against them with respect to insurance, and there was a whole litany of other things. And trust me, I have not read any of the briefs, I don't know all the arguments, but the purpose of my example is that the U.S. Supreme Court held that same-sex marriage is allowed. And that law came out, and now even if your state doesn't have a statute that says you can have same-sex marriage, the common law decided based on the Constitution allows you to have same-sex marriage. So it's a common law. There's no statutes. It's written in a case. It's court-made law. But because it is based, the Supreme Court based this law on the Constitution, it's the law of the land, and it's accepted. Now, the second case that we all know about that's been in the news over the last year and a half is Roe v. Wade. For 50 years, Roe v. Wade was a common law case that was constitutionally supported that said you could have legalized abortion in every state in the country. That's what the court said. And for 50 years, it was held because it's a written down court case that was constitutionally allowed. Obviously, the Supreme Court changed that. And what the Supreme Court said, a lot of people think the Supreme Court said that they banned abortion. People think black and white that getting rid of Roe v. Wade banned abortion. That's not what they did. What the court said was the decision of common law, and there's issues about precedence, and I don't want to get into whether it's right or wrong or anything. This court said, that common law that we made there wasn't constitutionally supported. So they just basically eliminated this common law, and so this case now comes in, it sits down here, Roe v. Wade, but it's not supported by the Constitution. And so now what the discussion is, for people that are on the favor of abortion, they want to get a federal statute. Because the court has now, the current court has said, constitutionally you don't have a right to abortion. So the next level for that to be federally across the common land, across the land, would be a federal, because there are various states that allow it, and there are other states that have restrictions on it, but there is no federal overall the whole nation on abortion. So that's just kind of how it works. Like, so you have this common law that was supported by the Constitution, the Supreme Court decided it's not supported by the Constitution, so the only way to get to be the law of the land at this point is to say it's statute. Okay? Two other ones, contracts and agreements at the bottom of the list. Contracts is what we're going to talk about almost all the rest of the semester, or not, at least for the first half of the semester. And then we'll talk about contracts specifically, but it's kind of running through our entire class. Contracts are agreements between parties. And while it's not considered a law, per se, if I have an agreement with you, we must follow our agreements. And if one of us breaches that agreement, common law or an executive order or statute of the Constitution will tell us who wins between us. So we have this agreement between us, and it could be oral, written, or implied, and if one of us violates or breaches that agreement, we're going to look to 1 through 5 up above to figure out, and most of it's going to be number 5, common law, we're going to figure out who is right and who is wrong. So that's why it's down on the list, because in order to enforce it, you got to look up. And then the last one here, custom and practice, this is really important to your profession. Because here's the thing, I write contracts all the time. So for my, did I tell you guys last week I did the Herbal Factory? Okay, I will talk about that all the time because it's like my favorite client, and it's, they give me candy all the time, and it's, I'm really proud of the building. So it's like an example I use all the time. And ironically, long before the teaching class, in my 14th year, and I would always use examples of different things. And so Carol became my client in 2017, 2018, I don't know. So I've been teaching the class for about 5 years by the time. And I used to use an example, I would say, instead of saying, I'll use different examples throughout. I'll talk about houses and this and that, like three-bedroom house, three-bath, and we use these generic ones. Completely ironic, because I didn't ever know I was going to get terrible as a client. My example of a large-scale industrial project was always a candy factory. I always used to talk about a candy factory, and then Kismet, I get the candy company. But in any event, custom and practice, when you enter into a contract, when I write my contracts for Herbal, that was like a 300-page contract. Lots and lots of documents, lots and lots of words. But you know what? It doesn't cover everything. No contract will ever cover everything. Just like none of your drawings will cover everything. No matter what you guys draw, you will never draw 100% of everything that goes into that build. When you draw an elevation of walls and windows, and you're going to have a section cut through a window to see what the detail of that window is, but you're going to have a section cut of one window, and that's going to be representative of every window in that house or in that building or whatever it is. And you're going to have a section of the wall section. And what's going to happen is there are going to be times where there's going to be a connection in a corner, there's going to be a soffit that way it runs, and your drawings won't have that detailed out. So what happens is the contractor should know how to handle that because they build stuff. And what are they going to rely on? They're going to rely on the custom and practice in the industry. The contractor is going to know how to build things. They're going to know if they see this wall and it's a balloon frame system, they're going to know how to build a balloon frame system with 2x4s and how to put that wall together. And they're going to know how to frame out a window, we hope. And then it's going to look like your drawings. So what's relevant for what you guys do as designers, what's relevant for you guys to do as projects are being built, and what's really important is that everyone that is signing the contract are applying custom and practice in the industry. And if the contract's breached, it may be breached because they failed to apply the custom and practice. They built that balloon frame wall incorrectly. So they didn't follow custom and practice, even though we, and everybody should, which resulted in a breach, which resulted in series of whether common law says one party breached or the other, and maybe, but very rarely in the construction world, but maybe that could be because they violated a statute or they violated an administrative order because they didn't follow building codes and the wall fell down. All these things could come in just from the custom and practice. Does that make sense? Any questions on that? One thing I love about this slide and this part of this one piece of lecture, that's why I have a question or two on the exam about it, actually helps you guys figure out like what you're doing going on forward. I mean, this doesn't just apply to architecture. Like, you can go in and, you know, you got a speeding ticket. Why did you get a speeding ticket? Because you violated a statute. Is that constitutional? Maybe the red light was hidden, wherever it is. So there's different things that apply the rest of your life on just how this hierarchy works. Okay, moving on. Claims. So we're going to talk about claims. So claims I keep saying the word breach. Breach means that one party didn't follow through on the agreement. Now, you can have claims, civil and criminal. What I have here, because there are claims, somebody's injured. An injury may be a physical injury. That's the tort. Somebody could be injured because there's trespassing. That also falls in the world of tort. Or somebody could be injured because the contract was breached. The wall fell down and I had to rebuild it. And I lost, I was injured for money. I mentioned my email last night that I can talk, because we'll get about arbitration. I'm in the middle of a 12-week arbitration right now, and it's about a breach of contract and whether the contractor properly built this building. And so the injury there is, nobody got injured, thank God, although there was a lot of unsafe elements in the space, but the injury there is my client has to spend a lot of money to fix the building. So she has a claim against the contractor. We need laws to figure out what it is, and so we're arguing what case law and common law applies. Obviously, there's civil and criminal claims. And then we're going to talk principally about civil claims. We're going to talk about claims against design professionals. That's who you guys are going to be. Claims against the owners. Largely, I represent owners, so I spend a lot of time whether it's claims against me because I didn't pay a contractor, or my client didn't pay a contractor, or the client, the owner has a claim against their architect or contractor. Claims against contractors, and then claims against subcontractors, consultants, and others. So downstream, as we figure out how the tree is and all this works. When we talk about what actually is a claim and how do we fix it, how do we resolve it, and we'll work on part of the hierarchy of everything of how we resolve it. Two categories of claims. I've mentioned this a couple times now: tort and contract. What makes a tort claim? Injuries, physical injuries, trespass, kidnapping, battery, restricting people's ability to do stuff. It has to do more with personal, necessarily, than monetary, although you can get monetary damage if there is a tort injury. That could be a remedy for you. But it has to do with people and physicality and things like that. Contract claim is the agreement between two parties. The contract, at the very basic level, is just an agreement between, I said two parties, a contract, listen to this, that may be an exam, a contract can be between two parties or more than two parties. So a breach of contract is really, if there's an agreement, written or oral, breach of contract is when there are different parties and they haven't followed the agreement, okay, at the basic level. Now, to have a claim against someone, there must be a duty. On the tort side, you have a duty to act reasonably and safely to the public at large. So when you get in a car accident and someone is hurt and they break their leg or they get a whiplash or what have you, you've injured them. And if that car accident was caused because you didn't drive properly, you were unsafe, you breached your duty to the public at large to drive safely. Now, a statute's told you have to drive safely or at least speed limit and mind the stop signs and stop lights. But as public at large, you have a duty to the general public to act safe and not injure others. That's your duty in the tort world. In the contract world, the duty is defined by the terms of the contract. I agree, if I do architectural services for you, you will pay me $10,000. My duty to you is to give good architectural services. Your duty to me is pay. Those are your duties defined by the agreement. If you don't have those duties, there can't be a claim. Somebody can't just come to you as an architect and say, hey, where's my drawings? And you're like, I don't even know who you are. We didn't have agreements. So, I mean, I know that's really simple and basic, but you have to establish what those duties are to have a contract claim. So, the next thing, the next element of a claim is there must be a breach of that duty. You drove unsafely. You breached your duty to the public at large, which this individual's part of the public was injured. You failed to pay me that $10,000. Yeah, but your work was crappy. I gave you five. It's enough. Doesn't matter. The contract says you owe me 10. And my argument is it does matter because you didn't deliver good drawings. You breached first. And that's where fights happen, and that's where I get paid because I have to sort out whose argument is better. But you must have a breach of the duty, and that's the failure to perform. I failed to drive safely. I failed to pay your $10,000. I failed to give you the proper drawings. I had a duty to do those. I failed. Now I have the breach of that duty. And then we have this element down here, which is going to be very relevant to your profession. My example of, I know I owed you 10 grand, but your drawings were crappy, so I only paid you 5. I think that's enough. Well, who's to decide whether your drawings were good enough? It's what's called the standard of care. That's what we have at the bottom of this thing here. You as an architect, and we'll say this over and over and over again in this semester, you as an architect have a responsibility, and normally it will be a contractual duty, to perform in accordance with the standard of care, which just means you must act as a normal architect, not a super architect, a normal architect, designing the type of design, so you're not going to have to design a hospital to the standards of a nuclear power plant. So you're a normal architect doing the type of building and the location of where you're going to be doing it. So when you design a house in Chicago, you don't have to design it for earthquake loads in California. So your standard of care is not based on the California, it's based on the location. But if I'm designing a house that's going to be built in LaGrange, it may have a different standard of care than a house that's going to be built in Kenilworth on the lake. Because it's the location of that house, the standard of what you expect in one area versus another area. So the standard of care is this, it moves, it flows, it's never static. That's why when you write in a contract, you could, and some lawyers do, but normally what you write in the contract is you must perform in accordance to the standard of care, and then when you have a dispute over whether somebody did those drawings, you look at what's the normal architect going to do, what's the type of building, and where was the location? So what were the expectations that come with that? And so that could be a breach. And so what's interesting about this is, as a designer, your drawings might have been sufficient for a condo development, and you didn't breach the standard of care. But if it was for a hospital that needed high tolerances and things about airflow exchanges and what the surgical suite is and everything else, it might not have met that standard of care. So the same type of drawings could be crappy for one and completely sufficient for the other. So that's what, when you go in, did we breach that duty? Did you perform in consistent with standard care? That's a lot of the arguments, and that's where my stuff is. Question? So that's a great question. The question is, how much is the standard care written out in the contract? And we'll eventually get that. I'll show you a provision. What the contracts typically say is the architect must perform in standard care. That's what it says. And they don't go into descriptions. Now, sometimes you might say the best standard of care. Sometimes a lawyer in their drafting will say, especially if it's important, like if it's a building where it's critical, where you need to make sure we establish more specificity to put and inject more objectivity into it, you may say they need to perform to the standard of care in accordance with a nuclear plant. And sometimes it's obvious. Maybe you don't have to write a nuclear plant because they're designing a nuclear plant, but if there's in this gray zone of like, you know, am I doing an industrial warehouse or am I doing something that's going to have, even though it's an industrial area, an industrial warehouse that needs more specificity, you might put that in. The other argument you're going to try to make is you're going to say, attached to this contract is this big stack of documents and all the scope of what the owner's looking for. And you can say, there's enough information in that that the architect should understand what that standard of care is. And so, but most of the time, I am representing an architect, don't want the specificity in that standard of care. I want it to be a judgmental thing later on that somebody else is going to be like, yes or no. But the owner may want it more specific to try to get a higher standard of care, is the best way to say it. Okay? All right. Yeah, the next thing you have to do, so it's duty, breach of duty, injury. If I gave you crappy drawings, but you can still build the house and it didn't breach the standard of care, you're not injured. Pay me my $10,000. I know you don't like the drawings, maybe they're not pretty, but this contractor says he can build it, and it's what this house is going to look like, you're not injured. You don't have to pay more money. For the $10,000 that you owe me, I told you I'd design you a house that we could build for $250,000. This contractor says he can do it. He's a good contractor. He can put up. It only costs you $250,000 to build. You have no injury. So you have to have an injury. If I'm speeding down the road and you stop suddenly because like, oh my God, this person almost ran me over because they ran a red light, but you stop suddenly and you weren't injured, yeah, the other driver, me, violated my duty to public. I ran a red light. I violated a statute. But the person in the other car never had an injury. So there was a duty, there was a breach of duty, no injury. So you have to have that. In the tort, physical injury or impeding your person or what have you, and the contract, a lot of times it's going to be monetary. So you have to have that. If you don't have that, you're out. Sometimes you have cases where you can say and you can show the other side was liable and everything, but if you can't show that it's going to cost you more money to fix it, doesn't matter. Causation, next element. Who or what was the cause? It's pretty clear in a car accident, isn't it? Because somebody hit somebody and that's the cause, right? Yes. Or maybe not. Maybe instead of two cars hitting each other, maybe somebody was walking in a crosswalk and got hit by someone. Was it a dart out? Did somebody try to run across the street quickly to beat the light? And that's why they got hit. as opposed to, oh, because you as the driver, you should have been slowing down, you should have been paying attention. So the causation, you have to be able to show there's a causal connection between this injury and the breach. Clearly, if I ran through the red light or ran through the stop sign, I could be considered there was a duty and a breach of duty. But if the person ran out in front of me as a dart out or whatever, it may or may not be my fault. So that's some things. And we won't have to get into some things are guaranteed cause, and you don't even have to prove causation, and there's some ipso facto and other Latin terms, we don't have to worry about that. But sometimes there's an automatic, you don't have to prove causation, but a lot of times you have to prove it. The case I'm in right now, I have to prove for my client, because I represent the client that had the crappy, poorly built building, is I have to prove the reason why this roof leaks is because they built it wrong. And the fact that the leak exists is not enough. I have to show what was wrong with the construction, and then we have to figure out, was it the roofer, was it the carpenter, was it the tiler? Who was the responsible party, the mason, for this? So that's what happens in there. And then damages. Damages is tied to injury. Is there a value to the injury or loss? So, you know, you could be injured and maybe you have hospital bills, or you could be injured because you have to rebuild that wall or fix that leak. And so that's what you want at the bottom, is you're asking, and this is at the end, that's what you're going to be asking for someone. Give me money. I want damages for my injury caused by their breach of duty. See how that goes? I have damages caused by their injury as a result of their breach of duty. That's how you get all the way through to get a claim and prevail. Does that make sense? Okay. So, if you have all the elements of the claim, now how do you get it resolved? Like, you go to the lawyer and you're like, oh my God, they built this house, and it leaks, and I got to spend money on it, so I clearly, they were supposed to build me a proper house, and it clearly there's a breach it because it's leaked, and clearly this caused the leak is because they did the roof improperly because somebody told me they built it improperly, and now I got damages. What do I do? How do I resolve that? Because now I come to me as a lawyer, and I say, we have a couple routes. We go arbitration, or we go to court. And that's how we solve this. So, duty, breach of duty, injury, causation, damages, old school. The old school, way back when, in the time we had the monarchies, eye for eye, go out and fight it out. You know, you lost your hand, we cut their hand off. That's what they used to do. Now, we're a little more civil, we have the legal methods. So what are the dispute resolution procedures to resolve that? We have binding dispute resolution processes and non-binding. And the point of the non-binding is the concept is, you know, litigation and courts and lawyers are really expensive. So can we figure out a way? And this is more going to be more common in contracts than torts. But can we figure out a way that these parties that at some point in time came to an agreement and they were on the same page, can they figure it out without going to court? And they do it through, on the non-binding side, negotiation. And then it would be limited to the skill and the attitude of the parties. So we're going to talk about how you can talk, like, especially in the construction case. Almost every contract that I ever write in the construction world, it requires that all parties must meet before they go to mediation, before they go to arbitration, before they go to court. They must meet with a senior executive, somebody at a level above the project people. Because on the project side, you're going to have the architect that's a project manager, you have the contractor project manager. They may hate each other. They may have such animosity, and so you want them not to be part of those negotiations. So it's the next level up, somebody that may have a little bit more of a removed business perspective to it. And so that's going to be who's going to have the understanding, the skill, and the attitude to be able to negotiate in a non-binding. And you have to, and by the way, it's not required. I put it into my contract so it becomes a contractual requirement to have this non-binding discussion. But that's not in every contract. It's something that's often added in. But it's something you want to encourage. And so when all of you guys get out there and you start practicing architecture, if you ever ask to help out on a contract, say, hey, I remember this guy back when I was in grad school, and he said we should have some kind of non-binding discussion so we can try to work things out. That'll save your company a lot of money because you can probably work things out when you take away those that are in the field. You can then have, again, a non-binding element is if it doesn't work with the executives talking to each other, you could have what's called mediation. Mediation brings in a third-party neutral, someone that understands construction or design, and he or she will listen to both sides tell their story. Most of the time, the mediator has a legal background. What's going to happen is you're going to exchange some documents, you're going to talk about it, you're going to try to figure out what each party's positions are. You designed it wrong, you didn't pay me. And then you're going to sit down in a room or over a Zoom And the mediator is going to listen to both sides of the story, and then you're going to separate out, and the mediator is going to sit down with you and your client, or the client and the attorney, and they're going to say, you know, your case is really bad for this reason. Or they're going to say to the other side, your case is really good for this reason. To have this independent neutral make a recommendation. You know, you surely should pay them like $9,500 or your $10,000. The five wasn't enough. You should take like seven, and their job is to try to settle negotiation and come to a business resolution. But this mediator has no binding power. He or she will tell them, you know, if you don't settle this case, you're going to be paying Hanahan a lot of money in legal fees. Don't you think it makes more sense? If you don't settle this case, even if you're okay with paying Mike all these legal fees, you may lose for these reasons. So this individual, this mediator, is going to give an informed recommendation, but neither party is required to follow it because it's non-binding. I bring this up as mediation because mediation is extremely successful in construction. I would say 80% of my cases settle for mediation. Now, hopefully none of you in this room ever have to be in a dispute because of your services, or even your firm has to be in dispute. And I would say that 80% or 90% of your firms will never get into a dispute. But if you're in that unfortunate 10 to 20%, and you have mediation, and again, you've told your boss, hey, we should put this into the agreements, she may be happy for you because it may save her money because you come to a business resolution. And it's a good thing. Finding side. Litigation or arbitration? Litigation's court, judge, jury. And we'll get into the anatomy of the case in the next couple slides of how that works, but that's what it is. It is binding because the court is going to make a ruling, and that ruling is going to require you to do what they say. And if you don't do what they say, then they can go out and they can get the executive branch, would be the police force or whoever, to enforce that and garnish your wages or whatever it might be. So it is binding. Arbitration is also binding. Arbitration is by written agreement only, though. It's one thing you got to remember. When you enter into that contract, it must say the parties agree to arbitration. If the contract is silent on that, a dispute will be solved by litigation going to court. So the parties must agree in advance to use the arbitration process. If they don't agree in advance, they'll go litigation. Now, they could agree, like I could call somebody up and say, I'm going to file a lawsuit against you, and the other side could call back and say, will you agree to do it by arbitration? You can make that agreement at any time. Even if it wasn't in the written contract, you can agree at a later time. But once you're down that road and that court case is filed, normally the horse is out of the barn, it's too late, and the other side's going to say, no, I wasted, you guys didn't listen to me in my negotiation, you didn't listen to me in the mediation, I'm done with you, I'm just taking you to court, I'm going to hammer you. So it's best if you want to do arbitration here. I'm in this 12-week arbitration right now because it's the people that are involved, there's some confidentiality to it. So they didn't want it to be public record. They didn't want it to be filed with the court system. That's one reason why you got arbitration. It's not my favorite forum, I'll be honest, because I think a lot of times there's kind of like a split the baby, meaning, oh, you're asking for $1 million. You think it should be $200,000, I'm going to meet in the middle. Like, there's never, if you feel that way. There's also lots of problems with the court system. It's very expensive, it's time consuming. I will say this, my arbitration's been going on since 2019, so it's not been any faster, and it's been really expensive. So there's pros and cons to both. But these are your two binding methods, litigation, arbitration. Any question on those? Okay. The anatomy of a lawsuit. Just so you know, a lawsuit's court. Arbitration is hearings, so that's the difference. So we're going to go through how it works. Now, there's elements of this anatomy of a lawsuit that factor into arbitrations. There's pieces of it. And I'm going to go through this relatively quickly because I'm not going to have you say, okay, tell me how we get to court and how we go through this. But so I'll go through this pretty quickly, but I want you to understand it just in case you guys find yourself, whether it's somebody sued you because you got in a car accident. God forbid that we all get into that and nobody gets into that, but that could happen. Or you find yourself somewhere down the line where you got to buy a house and it leaks and you need to sue your contractor, or maybe at your job. So it's going to help you for that. First part, plaintiff. The plaintiff is the injured party. I have the claim, I'm the plaintiff. The defendant, the one that's I'm defending that I didn't do anything wrong. That's what they call defendant. So those are two big parties. And there could be multiple other defendants downstream and everything else. But for purposes of this, it's just plaintiff and defendant. First thing they do, hire attorney, let's hope. Although in Illinois and many states, if you have an individual claim, you as a person You don't have to hire a lawyer. You can represent yourself by yourself. But a company, a corporation, or anything other than an individual, by law in Illinois, must be represented by a lawyer. I'm sure some lawyer wrote that statute, because then we get paid. But the court said, as an individual, you can bring your own thing. You need to file an appearance, meaning I appear myself in court. I'm just filing to say for an appearance. And then you serve your pleadings, which is the complaint. Summons is the service of it. You've been served, summoned. The complaint is a written document. Here are the facts of the case. Here's what I expected. Here is your duty. Here's your breach of duty. Here's the causation. Here's my injuries. Here's the damages I'm claiming. Your complaint needs to have all those elements in that. And then you serve that to the defendant and say, you have been served. And then you are now in a lawsuit. Make sense? Next. What does the defendant do when they get it? They're like, oh my God. Well, the first thing the defendant should do, actually, I should have a bullet here that says, hire an attorney. But that's what the defendant should do. Call somebody up and say, oh my God, I just got sued. What do we do? But they too have to file an appearance. They have to step up to the court. If you don't file an appearance and if you ignore it, what's the plaintiff going to do? I got a $1 million lawsuit against Tom, and Tom didn't show up to court today. And you say to the judge, I want an order entered awarding me my $1 million and everything in my complaint because they didn't show up. And the judge would be like, let's give them another 30 days. Did you serve sermons? They give a little bit of time and everything else. But if the defendant never shows up, you can get a judgment entered against them for the entire thing. You don't even have to prove it because they haven't filed an answer. So if you are served in the complaint as a defendant, you better make sure you get yourself on file as an appearance and you show up. And you may want to move to dismiss. You sued Bob Smith. My name is Bob Smith, but it's actually spelled with a Y-T-H-E. I'm Bob Smythe. You sued the wrong person. I'm going to move to dismiss. Or you sued me too late. You're allowed to bring a suit against me for only 4 years in the state of Illinois. It's year 5. You breached the statute of limitations. So there's certain procedural things you can go in the beginning to try to just get you out of the case. Hope you have that. Maybe you don't. The lawyer will tell you, though. If you can't get out on a motion to dismiss because it's the wrong party, the wrong claim, the wrong timing, you have to file an answer. And so what the answer is going to say, it's going to say, yes, I'm Bob Smith. Yes, I worked on this project. And then for all the other things that they say you did wrong, you're going to go deny, 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 deny. You're going to deny them all. And now we have a dispute. Plaintiff says you did these things wrong. Defendant says, no, I didn't. So we move forward. Now you may say, hey, not only did I not do anything wrong, but you didn't pay me. I have a counterclaim. Or the reason why I didn't do the drawings is because you didn't tell me to do this and this. So you have affirmative defenses and counterclaims. You want to file those to make sure that they are preserving your arguments against the other side. And then what happens is the cost and the expense of a lawsuit. It's called pretrial discovery. And so if you're in Cook County for the next 4 years, you're going to be battling back and forth, getting their documents, taking depositions, arguing to say, you're this, you're that, blah, blah, blah. And it's to exchange information so when you get to trial, you can tell your story of what really happened to the judge or jury. So the discovery phase is to discover information about it. What's going to happen is there's going to be documents exchanged, production documents, interrogatories, you're going to ask questions, and there are going to be crafty lawyers writing crafty questions to see if you can trip them up and how they answer. You're going to take depositions. A deposition is where you sit in the room, they ask you, or nowadays it's on Zoom, they ask you questions, there's a court reporter, you're under oath. So all these things happen to get more discovery. Sometimes you can send a subpoena to a third party. Hey, the lawsuit's between me and my architect, but the contractor may have something to say. I want to bring them into a subpoena. They're not a party to the case, but they are a witness. They can tell me a little bit about it. Discovery, length of time, forever. 2, 3, 4 years. Cook County's probably 4 years in discovery before you get to trial. It's a long time. Motion practice. Motion practice is you file with the court and you're like, hey, they were supposed to give me these documents and they didn't. They refused. I want the court to order that they must provide those documents. And the court's going to say, did you give them the documents, counsel? And she's going to say, well, I gave them some, not all. And the court's going to say, well, why didn't you give them all? And she's going to go back and forth to try to figure out those. Those are things that happen during discovery, is the jockeying for position, the figuring out of who's supposed to do what. And the court rules on those along the way. As I said in the bottom, it's the most expensive and longest part of a lawsuit. Trial's really expensive too, but the trial gets over in, I mean, mine's 12 weeks, but most of the time trials are 2-3 weeks long. So it's, but it's very expensive getting ready. But really the discovery, because it's for years, it's extremely expensive. Yeah, question. Great question. How do you know how long the trial is going to be? Well, what you hope happens is over the course of the discovery period, the parties start to narrow and focus on what the important issues are. And then each side sits down with their team and they say, who do I need to call as a witness to tell the story of these five important elements? And then you say, and how long does each person have to be on the stand to tell that story? And then you try to make a guesstimate. And so I'll just give you an example. Now, I keep talking about this 10, 12 weeks arbitration that I have. I only have hearings on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And my hearings go from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m., so it's not even a full day. But it's a five-hour day, and if we started from 9 to 5, but we had an hour for lunch and two half-hour breaks, we'd probably only get 6 hours of testimony in. We're straight 5 hours through. When we sat down and did estimates, we thought this week, because this was our first week, that we would get 4 witnesses up. We got 2. Even if you thought you could do that, even if you think, my first witness, I thought she would be in and out on the first day, she was there for 2 full days. And then the next guy that we thought was going to be there for like 2 or 3 hours, he was there for 5 hours yesterday. So you try to make your best estimates, you just don't know. And so my trial, unless we get it settled, and who knows if it's going to settle, when I'm staying 10 to 12 weeks, it may go 16. We don't even know. We're just, right now, and what may end up happening is as the panel, it's arbitration, there's a panel of 3 members, so they call it a panel as opposed to a judge or whatever. The panel may get to a point where, like, we've heard the story so many times because the witness say it over and over and over, move it along, and they may actually accelerate things. And so we may have a week where we're like, we thought we'd put on 2 people this week, and we get through 4 because they're moving it along. And in that scenario, then you're like, you got to scramble, and like, oh, is my witness ready? You know, and so the answer is you do your best, and you really don't know. So it's a lot of times the judges help you push things along to the arbitration panel. So, question? So, great question. So, what part of the trial costs money? So, when you file, it's a really interesting thing, and I never really talk about this, but I will because you asked this question. So, when you file in state court, when you're in court, you have a filing fee, but you don't have to pay the judges, or you don't have to pay the clerks, or you don't have to rent a space and everything else. That's all paid by the tax money. They're all government employees, so you don't have to pay for that. When you go for arbitration, because these are private individuals, our panel is made up of 3 construction lawyers. They're billing us at an hourly rate. And so on the arbitration side, it's very expensive on the administration side. We just got in a massive bill last night of the time that they have spent over the last X number of weeks preparing for it, that we have to pay. And it's split evenly between all the parties in the arbitration. Although some parties aren't paying, I won't get into that, but that's how it's paid for. That's just costs of the administration. Court, really cheap. Arbitration, very expensive for the administration. What other costs are there? Well, I have 3 lawyers on this case. It's a 8-figure case. I have 3 lawyers. I've got 2 paralegals. One of my other partners is backing me up for stuff that I have to do. And then occasionally we have another associate we have to pull in. And I'm in the hearing with my 2 other lawyers. So the 3 of us are in from 8 to 1. And we get done at 1 o'clock. We sit down and we have a debrief for the client. And then we have to do a whole bunch of research. I haven't left the office this week. I haven't left the office in 3 weeks before 11 o'clock at night. So I'm getting there between 6:30 and 7, and I'm there till 11 o'clock at night. So lawyer fees are very expensive. Then you have copying fees. Then you have court reporting fees. Then you have Zoom fees. We have this guy that all parties are sharing in, and everybody sent their documents. Like the exhibits we're using for the first 5 weeks of our trial, that we have over 500 exhibits, he's got our 500. He's got the defendant's 700. He's got 16 other defendants, and they have anywhere between 20 and 200 exhibits. So he's got thousands of exhibits, and he's there in some room on a Zoom putting them up on screen. So he's charging us a significant hourly rate. So there's all these costs that come in, and every single day this week, you think you're like, okay, I'm putting my witness on, and then I'm going to get done, and I'm going to prepare for my next witness tomorrow. And every single day, we finished the day, and we ran back, and we had to do research on a whole bunch of other issues, and we had to call other people, and we did all this other stuff. That's why I have to be there at 11 o'clock tonight, because I got to get all that stuff moving and rolling by 6 o'clock and get my secondary team doing all the research. And even this morning, as I was walking across the quad here, I was texting my two other lawyers on the team, and I'm like, we need to do this, 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 and this, and this. And one of them's like, I'm in court on another issue on this, and I will get somebody else on the team. That's why it costs so much more money, because everything's going all over crazy. So, okay. So we get to the trial. We're at the trial. If your case allows for a jury, and again, most of the time you have to, when you file the case, you have to say, I want a jury trial. Or sometimes the contract may say whether you have a jury or not. But you have to select a jury, and even that takes time. Sometimes you hire a jury consultant. Oh, that was the other thing. We hired a witness consultant. So when we prep our witness consultant there and tells them, this is how you present yourself. You should tell your story this way versus that way. We have research and history on how panels listen and what's important to them, and that helps you with your case. And so that's another expense, because I forgot about our jury consultant. So you can have a jury or you can have a witness consultant. But then you've got the jury seated in the box, or if it's a bench trial just means the judge is going to be making the decision. So if you ever hear that it's a bench trial, judge makes the decision. So, first thing you do when you get up there is you're allowed to make an opening statement. Now, if you see this, opening statement versus closing argument. You're trained in law school, there's some flexibility depending on your judge or whatever. When you make an opening statement, you are not allowed to argue the case. You will say, the facts will show this. You will learn that. You have to tell the jury or the judge what your story is about, what your case is about, but you can't argue. You're not going to say, the facts will show that they're a dirty rat. You can't make that argument. You can't say something that's inflammatory, that is conclusory. You are only in the beginning allowed to tell them what the case is about without argument. That's the statement. Then you put on evidence, you submit evidence and documents, you put on witnesses, you put them on the stand. We've all seen court, TV court shows and everything else. And it's not nearly as exciting as you see on TV. You don't have those kind of exciting drama gotcha moments, but thank God for Hollywood, because people like to do that, and I always enjoy watching those shows. But that's how you put in the evidence. And then you have the closing argument. And then you can do you dirty rat, or if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Then you can start doing those arguments. And that thing, because by that time the jury has heard all the facts. And your job as the lawyer is to summarize what your side of the case is in an argument. Now in arbitration, sometimes you don't get this. We didn't get opening statements. We had to put it in writing. The panel's like, we can read it, we'll figure it out. And we're not going to get closing arguments. I'm not going to be able to get up there and wave my arms and be impassioned. So I have to impassionately put it in my brief. I have to write it. I'll get a closing argument in a written paper. But, it's not like I'm going to do bold and italics and everything in there. I have to make a really good impassioned argument because arbitration, they can do what they want. The arbitrators can kind of like, it's a little more Wild West. And they're like, we're not doing closings. We'll have post-hearing briefs. Jury instructions after you're done with it. If it is a jury, sometimes you're going to say, we have to give the jury some direction. If you find A, you must decide B. The other side's going to say, no. The jury instruction should say, if you find A, you must find C. And there's fights over the jury instructions. But ultimately, you come to a decision, the judge helps you, and then you give this series of these instructions to the jury to help them decide the case. Now, juries are, and I think that we have the greatest system in the world, they're wonderful, but my first year Civ Pro teacher used to call them the 12 royal cantaloupes. Juries can do whatever they want. They can follow the instructions or not. They can decide what they want. A lot of times juries, thank God, and this is the reason why you have them, and that's why you want to make the impassioned plea and you want to wave your arms, is because they're going to make decisions on their gut and their feeling. And that's why getting a jury consultant, should these be the right people in the box, are important. So it's not to say that they don't follow the jury instructions, but sometimes they don't. And then you get a verdict of judgment. And that's how it goes. Now, oh my God, so we got this $1 million judgment against me. I still don't think I did anything wrong. What do? I file an appeal. We go to the next level. We're like, the judge erred. They let in evidence that shouldn't have been let in. The jury was tainted because they were allowing my witness or their witness to talk about hearsay or whatever you might say. So the appeal has to be based on something that was done wrong in the trial or that there was a misinterpretation or incorrect application of the law. So it's limited, the appeal. And you can have oral arguments. You can actually argue in front of the appellate court. There's going to be a panel of three judges, appellate judges, and you can make arguments in front of them. But that doesn't happen very often. In Cook County, or in the Cook County. Cook County is in the 1st District of Illinois, the appellate 1st District. About 97% of their cases are all decided on written briefs only. There's only about 3 or 4% of the cases have oral arguments. I've had in my 30-year career one time the opportunity to argue in front of the appellate court. I was scared out of my brain. I'd already been practicing for 20-some years, and it was really intimidating. I mean, I had done these mock things in law school and everything else. I'd like to think of myself as a pretty decent orator. And I was so scared. Because it was a big deal. And you know, the dollar value of the issue was about $1 million. It wasn't this massive $50 million thing. But they sit on this bench really high. Like they are, like the top of the, where they're standing, where they have the briefs, is above your head. And they're sitting above that. So you're there looking up at them. So they already are coming down on you, the judge on high. I mean, it's literally the judge on high. And there are three of them, and they can interrupt you whenever you want and pepper you with questions. Counsel, what about this? Counsel, what about this? You have to be ready, and you're getting peppered, and you're like, you're getting shelled. It was intimidating. It was an honor, though. It was really cool to do this, to be one of the 3 or 4% to be able to argue a case. And they only take oral arguments, or not only, but they mostly only take oral arguments because it's a novel theory that has never been decided. The other 97% of them, they go back to that chart and they look at the common law and they're like, ah, this is what all the other cases say, this is what it should be, let's move on. I mean, it's not as casual as that, obviously. But they, except there are briefs, and we ask, and you always ask oral arguments most times than I, and so I was very honored to be able to argue, and I won. And so like, it's one of the greatest things that I have. I have my name in the appellate court case, and I created new law, and I have, and it was actually in an area on insurance coverage law. It wasn't even on, it's related to construction, but it's a secondary part of me. Every one of my cases has insurance in it, and who's going to pay, is the insurance company's going to pay for these damages, but it's not my specialty. So that was, I was even more nervous. I'm like, I'm totally out of my lane up here. I'm arguing this. I wasn't totally out. I knew what I was doing, but it was not my, it was certainly not my comfort zone. You know, it was like, if I had grown up playing second base and they put me in outfield, it just was a little bit different for me. And so I was very excited to win. I have friends that are in the coverage, professionals, other lawyers that are my friends, and they have told me they've cited my cases. So it's like, well, it's a tiny little badge that I like. I have. I argued in front of the Illinois First District. I won, and I've had friends of mine that have actually cited my case. So that's kind of my, that's my little tooting of the horn here. So, any questions on the anatomy of the lawsuit? So the question, there's two things in your question. So the question is, if you do appeal, is it like a mistrial? So a mistrial is something that the judge, the trial court, would be determining. So a mistrial could be, it went to the jury, and it turned out the jury was getting information, and so there was something wrong that happened. So what a, and the litigants, the defendant and the plaintiff, one of them will move for mistrial, and they'll say to the court, they'll say, you know, judge, you added wrong evidence, I want a mistrial. Or you were speaking in public, or the jury was out speaking in public. Something that happened during the course of the trial, they felt, one litigant, one party or the other, felt was improper for the rules and the procedures of how a trial should go. And they will seek a mistrial. Sometimes the court will grant it. If it has to do with whether the court allowed in wrong evidence, the judge will always deny it because they're like, of course I read in the wrong evidence. You're never going to have a judge say, oops, I screwed up, I'm going to declare a mistrial myself. Maybe not never, but that happens. But you can then appeal the decision. So what the appeal could be the judgment or verdict of the jury, and you can say that it's against the manifest weight of the evidence. The appeal could be because the court allowed in improper evidence. The appeal could be that there was misconduct that happened. But you have to define what those issues are. And so the appeal is saying what happened at the trial court level, something happened and I asked for relief during that period of time. And then you go up to the trial court. So like that's why you may hear the term preserve your record. So like, let's say I want to enter in a piece of evidence and you don't like it. You're going to say, I object, Your Honor, that shouldn't come in for these rules, A, B, and C. You are preserving your record. Now, when the judge says your objection is overruled, I'm going to allow that evidence in. You have now, and if it turns out you really think that evidence should not have come in because A, B, and C were violated, these rules of the court or whatever, that will be, you will now have preserved your rights. So when you file an appeal, you will attach for the appellate court the record, the actual court transcript that says, here's the document, here's my objection, here's the overruling of my objection, the entrance of the evidence going in, and here's the case law, the common law, that says that shouldn't have happened. And the appellate court's going to look at all this, and of course the other side's going to make their arguments, it should have happened, blah, blah, blah. The judge won't make arguments. The other side's going to say it was proper and this and that. And then the appellate court's going to balance the scales and see who should win. Okay? Mine that I argued was the interpretation and the legal application of a provision in an insurance contract. It was really boring. But it was important for my client, so. Okay, I talked about arbitration a lot, but that was the anatomy of the lawsuit. We'll go through this really quick. So you have a demand for arbitration, not a complaint. It's called demand versus a complaint. It's a horse of a different color, that's all it is. You're a claimant, not a plaintiff. So you just have a different name, that's it. You have an answering statement as opposed to an answer, and it's a respondent, not a defendant. So it's really they just call you something different. I'm a claimant in this case, not a plaintiff. I'm a respondent, not a defendant. So that's no big deal. In arbitration, in state court, you have to do that deny, 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 and you have to file an answer in writing. Arbitration, you could write one sentence. I deny everything in their complaint. Here you go. That's it. You don't have to go through and deny everything individually. There's an arbitration selection process. So when you file in court, you're automatically assigned a judge. In arbitration, you get a list of potential arbitrators, and the two parties, for this example, we're just going to say there's a claimant and a respondent. The two parties look at that list, they're like, I like this one, this one, this one, I don't like all these other ones, I like this one and this one. So the 15 people, you like five, and you send that back to the American Arbitration Association. The other side does the same thing. If any of them match, one of them becomes on your panel. And you keep doing that until you get three matches. In the case that I'm in right now, it's been so contentious that we went through three rounds. We went through over 50, maybe I think like close to 60 potential panel members. We got one that everybody agreed on. And so by the time we got to the fourth one, the arbitration said, you know, we're going to invoke another rule. We're just going to assign you two and you're stuck with it. So we have three panel members. The case is here in Chicago. All three of my panel members are in the Detroit area because they couldn't agree to anybody in the Chicago area. And most of the time, the panel members are lawyers. So like, I don't like him. I don't like her. I've worked with them. I haven't worked with them. So as all these people that it's all personal, you know. And like, so we have some really good potential panel members in the Chicago area. None of them are on the list. But that's what happens. So how many panel members? It could be by contract. Most of the time it's going to be one or three. Kind of the general rule of thumb is if your dispute's less than $1 million, it's one panel member. If it's over $1 million, it's three panel members. I haven't seen an arbitration with more than three. Because it's really expensive. So, any questions on that? Limited discovery. So, in court, there's like all this restrictions and these rules that you follow of how discovery is and everything else. In arbitration, it's kind of like I said, a little more Wild West. So, what we had is we had an order from the panel that said, turn over your project file. So we didn't have to file requests or interrogatories or anything else. It was as simple as turn over your project file. I have no idea if we got everything from everybody, but that's just the order that we got. So it's different. Arbitration is supposed to be faster and cheaper. It is not. Because lawyers like to dumb things up. But you have this document exchange. You still can have interrogatories. You can still take depositions. We took 28 depositions in 7 weeks. We had three or four depositions almost every week. And they were 7 hours a day. It was brutal. So you can still have depositions. Decisions on discovery, if you have violated the exchange of documents, the discovery, or if you violated some deposition rule, the panel's going to make a decision whether it was right or wrong. So the panel has kind of, the panel sits up there as like more like the royal court. They're like a judge, but they have a lot of leeway. They can do a lot of things. There's very limited control over what's turned over. Like I said, we were supposed to get the project file from the contractor. Did I get everything? I really don't know. But you still can go out. Remember I said if I had a lawsuit or I've had a claim against an architect, but I think the contractor has something to say, I can still send a subpoena to a third party to get that information in. So it's a little different. It's not nearly as rigid and formal in the arbitration for discovery. Evidentiary hearing. So you don't go to trial. You have hearings. It's the same thing. I mean, I'm putting on witnesses. I'm asking questions. We're entering evidence. It's just called a hearing versus a trial. Opening statements, as I said, we don't have one in ours, but you can in some arbitrations. Witnesses. Yes, you can have witnesses. Now, the difference in what's the biggest difference in arbitration, by far, the biggest difference when you're at hearing, trial, whatever you want to call it, is the rules of evidence are really loosely enforced. I won't have you guys worry about what hearsay is and how documents go in and exceptions to hearsay, but there are very strict requirements about getting evidence in front of a judge or jury. And if you don't follow those, that evidence can be excluded. In the arbitration hearing for the last 3 days, when people make objections, other than one time, the lead panel member said, "Counsel, this is arbitration. We are smart enough to know what's important or not. Move it along. We can listen to this testimony." Or, "Counsel, we understand your objection to this document, but we're going to let it in. Move along." So they would rather hear more than less. They don't want to get caught up in the rules. They would rather hear the story. That's a plus and a minus. If you have some stuff that you don't want in, it's probably going to get in. It's going to look bad for you. But if you really want to tell the story, you want to be confident that the people making the decision really hear everything, that's good for you. So, you may have closing arguments. What we're going to have is written briefs. And then the award will typically be in writing. Sometimes it's just you pay him $1 million. Sometimes, though, you ask for a reason award. We want you actually to write out why you made this decision. The biggest problem with arbitration is no right of appeal. If you lose, if you remember this couple of slides before, if you don't like the decision in the trial court, you can go to the appellate court. Arbitration's no, unless you can prove that an arbitrator was biased. Oh, I found out later that they were married to the cousin of the defendant or the respondent. They had a personal bias. They used to work for this company, whatever. Or they were so egregious in the error of law that they completely ignored the statute that said, if it's red, it's red, if it's blue, and they ruled that it was yellow. If you can show that it was such an egregious violation of law, that's it. And the amount of times that you can overturn an arbitration decision is like less than 0.1%. It's tiny. It rarely happens. So you're stuck. But that's the choice you make. So that's the kind of the anatomy of the arbitration. And then very quickly, we'll get finished with this part, the last part of this. Mediation I talked a little bit about before. Mediation happens before both trial and before arbitration, and it's a non-binding business resolution tool. Sometimes you combine it, you go like, well, we'll do mediation, and if we don't like it, we'll go straight into arbitration or whatever, but it's a non-binding. And the point of it is to have the parties talk. And so you have this third-party independent neutral, and you do what's called evaluative or facilitative. Evaluative means that the arbitrator is going to evaluate the basis of the claim, and they're going to work in this thing under the evaluative. It's going to be more like what a judge is going to do. They're going to weigh the balance is and everything else. In any arbitration, they're going to have an evaluation process, but the evaluative arbitration process is much more on, I'm sorry, the evaluative mediation process is much closer to the hearing slash trial. We're going to balance and evaluate, and we're going to give you a reasoned decision. Facilitative, they don't necessarily evaluate the claim in great detail. They don't look at the case law. They don't dig in. What they facilitated do is they shuttle back and forth between the rooms. And they say, let me hear what your case is. Let me hear what your case is. You know, this is where your problems are. This is where you're not. It's more of a gut type reaction. I'm not saying that the people that do it are kind of winging it or everything else. But a facilitative mediation listens to the people. They react to the people. It's more organic. And both have their benefits. I have had cases where I want, because my expert is so strong and what went wrong is so nuanced, that it's not about a feel-good. It's about someone evaluating whether my client's problems or what they suffered needs to be corrected because the expert said it was this. For that, I would like to have an evaluative mediation. If I feel that there needs to be some back and forth and people need to understand what's going on and it may not have this in-depth, I will do a facilitative mediation. Like I said, facilitative, much more mediator, intermediary process. Evaluation is the strengths and weaknesses. Again, even in the facilitative, they're going to bring in evaluation. And even a good evaluative mediator is going to do some facilitation, but there's going to be a balance of one versus the other in how you do that to resolve the dispute.
And then the last slide on here is the process. What do you do for mediation? Well, you have these individual meetings, and sometimes you have written submissions to tell each other what parties did right or wrong, what their cases are. That's really to inform the mediator what the story's about. Then you're going to have some joint sessions between the parties, and that's going to have where you all meet in the same room, and maybe you like kind of yell back and forth at each other, I did this, no, you did that, no. It's actually what it does on this third point is it actually makes the witnesses psychologically, it gives the parties the ability to air their dirty laundry. A lot of times, what happens in a dispute, especially in the construction process, is the owner gets so mad at the architect, or the owner gets so mad at the contractor, they don't want to talk anymore. So they never get in a room together, and they never be able to talk back and forth and say, you did this wrong, no, you did this wrong. And that actually helps that, and that's part of the facilitation process. But that's what happens. So it gives you the chance to have your day in court. Then the mediator is going to separate the people into separate rooms, and then he or she is going to go back and forth and do some of the shuttle diplomacy, whether it's going to be in the light of more evaluative or more facilitative. But that's how they try to resolve it. I've had mediations that we've had like one day and then we come back a couple weeks later just for scheduling. It's not like it has to be done automatically in one or two days in a row. And then hopefully you have a resolution. But remember, the resolution is a business resolution and it's non-binding. So that's what you want to take away from the mediation is no one must follow what the mediator says. Okay? All right. We're done with this. What you guys want to take like a 5-minute break? Or do you want me to keep going?